Well, if you'll open up your Bibles again to the book of Psalms and the 77th Psalm. Some of us here this morning will be very at ease. We will be in a happy place in our lives. A friend of mine, a pastor, used to describe people's lives as a merry-go-round. Sometimes you're up and sometimes you're low. Many people here may be up, many people may be kind of in the middle, but there'll be some here this morning who are feeling very low. Maybe a crisis situation has come into your life. Maybe that leads you to ask questions. Where is God in it all? Where is the Lord in this time of trouble? Well, Psalm 77, the psalm that we're going to be looking at this morning, is a psalm written in a time of crisis. A time of national crisis. A time of personal crisis for the psalmist. A time especially of spiritual crisis. Crisis for the psalmist. We find in this psalm a man whose comfortable world has been shaken. A man who is in a storm of the soul. A man who is in a desperate time doubting the very promises and the love and the mercy and the grace of God. And we find in this psalm a man who is wrestling with God as he tries to make sense of it all. So we've got 3 points this morning. And our first point is the crisis. What is this crisis? What's going on? Well, the backdrop to this psalm is a scene of absolute chaos and destruction. Burning buildings, people crying, and dead bodies lining the streets. This psalm was almost certainly written soon after the destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar's army. The city was sacked. Men, women, and children had been slaughtered in their hundreds and in their thousands, and many others had been taken as captives into Babylon. Those who were left in a city smouldering and torn down. In fact, the 79th Psalm and the first four verses, they paint a terrible picture of what's gone on. We read, they have reduced Jerusalem to rubble. They have left the dead bodies of your servants as food for the birds of the air. The flesh of your own people for the animals of the wild. They have poured out blood like water all around Jerusalem. And there is no one to bury the dead. We are objects of contempt to our neighbours. Of scorn and derision to those around us. So the psalmist in Psalm 79 and here is describing a scene of total and utter destruction. But worst of all, far worse than Jerusalem lying in ruins, is the fact that the temple, the meeting place of God and his people, has been destroyed. In Psalm 79, again at the very beginning, we read, O God, the nations have invaded your inheritance. They have defiled your holy temple. So the psalmist looks at Jerusalem, the city of God, and it's been destroyed. He looks at the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the people of God, and they've been slaughtered. And he looks at the temple of God, the meeting place of God and his people. And the temple lies in ruins. And so as the psalmist looks at this situation, I think he asks the question that every one of us would ask. He says, God, where are you? Have you abandoned us? It's a terrible situation for the psalmist to be in. And so we come to our second point. And our second point, we're just going to simply work through the first 9 verses of this psalm. And we find that the psalmist is tired, that he can't sleep. Verse 1, he says, I cried out to God with my voice, to God with my voice. Immediately we can hear the desperation in his voice, can't we? He's not speaking in calm, soft tones. He's shedding tears. He's repeating himself to God. He cries to God because he's in such a terrible situation. He's pleading with God, but what is he pleading? Well, verses 2 and 3. He's pleading for help. We see verse 2 that the psalmist is troubled. He says, in the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. This psalm, as I said, is set in front of a terrible national disaster. The Babylonians have come into the city of Jerusalem and have destroyed it. There's a terrible backdrop to this psalm, a national crisis. But actually, what we find in these first 9 verses is that the psalmist's problem is not so much a national crisis. The psalmist's problem is a personal spiritual crisis. He is troubled and he's crying out to God. But what does he say? My hand was stretched out in the night without ceasing. Verse 2. My soul refused to be comforted. The psalmist in the night, he's stretching out his hands to God. There's a sense, isn't there, that he's pleading with God. What's he pleading for? He's pleading for help. Think of the times when you've watched the news and you've seen a famine-struck country and they're talking about the aid that's being delivered to that country, and you'll see a large van pulls up and the back doors open and there's several men standing on the top of the truck and they've got food aid. And they're passing out this food aid to the people who are there to receive it. And what are they doing? They got their arms stretched out and they're pleading for food. They're pleading for help. And that's what the psalmist is doing here. He's got his hands stretched out in the night. He's pleading for help from God. And yet it seems as though his prayers are bouncing off the ceiling, doesn't it? Verse 2, my soul refused to be comforted. Asaph is finding no relief in prayer. He's finding no comfort in God. He can't even find God. He feels utterly abandoned. One commentator puts it like this. He says, Asaph, as the leader of the temple worship, had previously lifted his hands in the sanctuary and received the Lord's blessing. But now, he lifts his hands and receives nothing. But why? Why can't Asaph find God? Why does he feel so abandoned? What's the barrier holding back God's presence? And the answer is fear. Fear of judgment. Verse 3. I remembered God and was troubled. I complained and my spirit was overwhelmed. When Asaph attempts to turn to God, when Asaph attempts to find God in prayer, he finds himself troubled and overwhelmed with fear. Why? Well, for many years, Judah and Jerusalem had continually turned away from God to the worship of idols. They had ignored the warnings of countless prophets, and even when the 10 northern tribes had been punished by God for their idolatry by being taken captive into Assyria, still the people of Judah and Jerusalem had refused to change. And God had warned them long ago, if you turn to idolatry, then I will throw you out of the land. Well, that judgment, it seems, has come. Jerusalem lies in ruins. The Lord has shown his anger. God's people, it seems, are under God's wrath. That warning that God gave many, many years ago, even before the people had entered the promised land, now the Lord has followed through on that warning. He's thrown the people out of the land. Even in Leviticus, it gives it stronger terms. It says the land will vomit you out. And that's what's happened to the people of God. They've been thrown out of the land. They've been slaughtered in their hundreds and thousands. And the temple, the meeting place of God and his people, is a smouldering ruin. And therefore, Asaph is overwhelmed with fear. God, in his anger, it seems, has brought destruction on his chosen people. So how can Asaph approach this angry God? How can Asaph cry out to the Lord for help when it seems the Lord is the one behind this very situation? It would be like a poor man who's in debt to a loan shark. And he can't pay. So he's on the run. And of course, if the loan shark gets him, it ain't going to be pretty. And so he's running for his life. And this poor man, he sits in a darkened room and he wonders, what can he do? Where can he go? Who can he turn to? And he knows that the one person he definitely cannot turn to is the loan shark. After all, it's the loan shark who's chasing him. It's the loan shark who he's trying to avoid. It's the loan shark who, if he catches him, is going to kill him. The loan shark is the last person this poor man can turn to. And that's how Asaph feels. If the Lord has come against his people, if the Lord has brought destruction on his chosen people, then it seems to Asaph the Lord is the last person he can turn to. Asaph is overwhelmed with fear. Verse 4 to 6. Asaph says, verse 4, you hold my eyelids open. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. The dark clouds of spiritual depression that the psalmist is under is now even having a physical effect on him. He can't sleep. He can't speak. There's just a sense of total despair. So what does he do next? Verse 5 and 6. Well, he thinks, well, let's try a bit of nostalgia. Let's think of happier times. Maybe that will help. So verses 5 and 6. I have considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. I call to remembrance my song in the night. I meditate within my heart. And my spirit makes diligent search. Asaph thinks back to happier times, a little bit of nostalgia, but does it really help? No, it doesn't. A friend of mine many years ago had a terrible time of it. His girlfriend, who he'd been with for years, walked out on him. And he would spend hours in his bedroom, simply staring at photos of her or holding on to anything that reminded him of her. And he would cry many tears, and we would try and pull him out of it, but it didn't seem to help. The more he stared at those photos, the more he stared at those things that reminded him of her, the pain just grew worse and worse, because it just served to remind him that that girl was no longer in his life. Well, for Asaph, he thinks back to happier times. But like my friend staring at pictures of his ex-girlfriend, it doesn't help. As he thinks back to the good old days, it only serves to remind him that now he's in the bad old days or the bad new days. It only serves to remind him of how desperate his situation really is. And of course, specifically, it only serves to remind him that God has seemingly walked out on his people. That God has turned his back on him. After all, why were the good old days good? The good old days were good because God was blessing his people. But now Jerusalem lies in ruins. The temple, the meeting place of God and his people, is a smouldering wreck. So what does that say about God's dealing with his people? What does that say about God's relationship with his people? Thinking back to the good old days, it just doesn't help Asaph, because it reminds him that of the awful situation that he's now in. This is a psalm of real desperation, isn't it? This is a psalm of real crisis. The psalmist's in a spiritual crisis, a crisis of the soul. And as he thinks on all these things, well, he reaches the end of himself. He gets to that point of absolute despair. And he asks six questions. Six questions that I think all of us can understand. All of us maybe have asked one or more of these questions before in a time of crisis. What does he say? Verse 7 and 9. 2, 9. Will the Lord cast off forever? Will he be favourable no more? Has his mercy ceased forever? Has his promise failed forevermore? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his tender mercies? Essentially, Asaph is asking one question, isn't he? Has God deserted his people? Has God deserted me? So the first 9 verses of this psalm are pretty desperate. But before we move on, I think it's important to say, isn't it, that these despairing questions that Asaph asks and this whole despairing attitude that he has, I think it's a feeling that can resonate with many of us here this morning, isn't it? Either today or in the past. Maybe circumstances in your life have led you to really question, does God really care? Heartbreak, bereavement, illness, prolonged unemployment, whatever it may be, and you just can't understand what God is doing. And maybe you think, does God just not care about me anymore? Has he just, in a sense, just left me to my own devices? Has he walked away from me? Maybe you've prayed over and over and over about this situation, and the more you pray about it, the more it hurts, because the longer your prayer goes unanswered. And the more you pray, you feel like Asaph, you don't find any comfort, because you say, Lord, why won't you give this to me? Or why won't you take this away from me? And you wonder, does God really care about me? Maybe like Asaph, you're wrapped with guilt. You're wrapped with that guilt and that sense that you're under the judgment of God. And when you come to him, you just feel overwhelmed with fear. And you constantly come to the Lord and you never feel the joy of salvation. You never feel the joy of assurance of knowing that you're loved by a loving God. You feel overwhelmed by fear. And you wonder, does God really love me? Could he really love a sinner like me? Someone who messes up so much. Someone who messed up in this way. And maybe you worry that ultimately he will reject you. And he will turn you away. Maybe like Asaph this morning, you're under the dark cloud of spiritual despair. You're in a spiritual storm of the soul. And the biggest question on your mind this morning is, has God turned his back on me? Has he completely cast me off? Well, thankfully, the psalm doesn't end there. If it did, I suppose we'd all go home at this point feeling pretty low. But in the second part of the psalm, verses 10 to 20, we find that Asaph, he gets a true perspective of God. He gains a true perspective. And the turning point in this whole psalm is verse 10. It's the hinge on which the whole of the psalm turns. Verse 10. And I said, this is my anguish. This is my pain. This is my trouble. But I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. Asaph decides to set his mind on the glory and the power and the mercy of God, as has been demonstrated to Israel in the past. And we see that verse 11, Asaph really has turned a corner because he uses the Lord's name. Verse 11, he says, I will remember the works of the Lord. Now this is the first instance in this psalm that Asaph has used the Lord's name. You can see it in your translation. It will be written Lord, but it will be written in capital letters. The best translation of that word is Yahweh. It's God's personal name. It's the name that God used with his people. And it was the name that spoke of God's covenant with his people, God's promise with his people. Now, what is a covenant? A covenant is an agreement. But of course, an agreement can be broken. You might decide with someone here this morning that this week you'll meet up for a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. And maybe the day before or the morning that you're going to meet up, you'll get a text message or a phone call and the other person will say, I just can't make it. And you had an agreement, but that agreement's been broken. Because agreements can be broken, can't they? Circumstances can change. Well, a covenant is more than an agreement. A covenant is a binding agreement. An agreement that neither party can simply opt out of. Think of a mortgage. You have a mortgage contract, don't you? I can't turn round to my mortgage provider tomorrow and say, look, I like my house, I want to stay living there, but I don't really like paying you this money each month, so I'm just not going to anymore, and we'll call it quits. What would the Halifax say? I don't think they would take it too well. Because you can't just opt out of a mortgage agreement. It's a covenant. It's a binding agreement. Well, the Lord had made a binding agreement, a covenant with his people. And this name, Yahweh, this name is significant because it represents the truth that he is a covenant-making, covenant-keeping God. This name which Asaph uses, the name which God used with his people, the name which God used when he created this covenant with his people, this name carries the weight of God's promise that he will love and protect his people. And so Asaph uses the Lord's name. And then he begins to focus on the Lord's character. He sees how that covenant-keeping protection over his people has been shown throughout the years of Israel's history. He says, verse 11 and 12, "Surely I will remember your wonders of old. I will also meditate on all your works and talk of all your deeds." It seems that the dark cloud of spiritual despair is beginning to break up. And finally, Asaph the psalmist is seeing the light, seeing the Lord in the light of his true character. And that's what he does, verses 13 and 15. Look, he says, "Your way, O God, is in the sanctuary." That's actually quite a bad translation. Far better if it says, "Your way, O God, is holy." And look, not only is God holy, but he's powerful as well. Verse 13 and 14. "Who is so great a God as our God? You are the God who does wonders. You have declared your strength among the peoples." So God is holy, he's powerful. But how has he shown that strength and power? Well, he's shown not only his power and his strength through the redemption of his people, but specifically, he's shown that he is the Lord who cares for his people. He cares for them in trouble. And the clearest place that we can see that is the Exodus, which is what Asaph begins to focus on now, verses 16 to 20. Let's think back to the Exodus. What was happening? There were God's people, and they stood on the banks of the Red Sea. Bearing down on them was the Egyptian army. An army of men who the previous night had lost their firstborn. These are men out for revenge. If they should catch the people of God, there will be a wholesale slaughter. And so for the children of Israel, standing on the banks of the Red Sea, having come out of captivity in Egypt, for them, the situation seemed as bleak as it could possibly be. And maybe as those people looked to the Egyptian army bearing down on them in the distance, those people would have asked this same question, wouldn't they? Has God deserted us? Has he brought us all the way into the wilderness simply to be slaughtered by the Egyptian army? So the people at the Red Sea were in a crisis situation, a situation that looked bleak. But then God intervened. Look at verse 16. "The waters saw you, O God, the waters saw you and were afraid. The depths also trembled." Asaph's using poetic language. And the language that he uses, what he's describing is this, that as the Lord approaches the sea trembles with fear. And it scatters. I don't know whether you've ever been at a service station in the middle of the night. If you do late night journeys up and down the country, maybe you will have. But often at services, I don't know why, but you find lots of rabbits. And during the day when there's lots of people around, the rabbits stay hidden. But at night time, when there's barely any cars, barely any people in the services. All the rabbits, they'll congregate on the green grass. And so if you're anything like me, you see, I want to say a herd of rabbits, but I don't think that's the right word. You see a group of rabbits, whatever the right term is, and you think, great, predator mode. And so you sort of creep up on them. And there they are, they're all sort of not thinking anything. And then suddenly you run out, jump and you scream, and it's really fun. All the rabbits run away. If it's been a boring drive, you're really looking for anything to keep you amused. Well, in a sense, that's how Asaph is describing the sea. The Lord comes to the sea, and the sea is terrified, and it scatters. And of course, Asaph is describing the parting of the sea. The sea was so afraid that it ran away. And so the Lord has parted the sea. And what does it say? Verse 19 even. Your way was in the sea, your path in the great waters, and your footsteps were not known. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. So the Lord has come to the sea and the sea has parted. And then unseen, the Lord has led his people as the great shepherd of his people that he is. And he's led them through the sea and into safety. What has Asaph realized? He seems to end this psalm in quite a blunt way, doesn't he? You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. What has Asaph realized? Well, Asaph seems to have realized this, that however bleak this situation may now look, God has never failed his people before. He is a covenant-keeping God. Then, now, and forever. So what does this psalm say to us? I think there's just two key things that we can bring from this psalm. And the first is this, the importance of persistent prayer. At his spiritual low point, what is Asaph's response? Verse 1, I cried out to God with my voice, to God with my voice, and he gave ear to me. Verse 1 is really a summary of the entire psalm. The psalmist is despairing in his relationship with God. He stretches out his hands and he cries for help, but it seems that no help comes. He tries to think of happier times, but that only seems to twist the knife. He finds no comfort in prayer. But what does he do? He carries on regardless. He's overwhelmed with fear. Yet still, he can't keep away from God. Asaph is persistent. Even though coming to God hurts, even though coming to God leaves him terrified and completely uncomforted, nevertheless, he cannot stay away. He's like a moth on a light bulb, isn't he? Light bulbs are hot, and therefore a moth can't stay on the light bulb because it will burn its feet. And so it comes to the light bulb, it jumps off because it's too hot, but then it's attracted to the light again, so it goes back. And you see a moth around a light bulb, it just can't stay away. It keeps on going, coming back and back for more. Well, that's how Asaph feels. It hurts as he comes to God. He's terrified. He finds no comfort. He feels pain. But he can't stay away. And it's only after his persistence and perseverance in prayer that God answers. Verse 1, I cried out to God with my voice, to God with my voice, and he gave ear to me. eventually the Lord gave ear to him. It seemed to Asaph as though the Lord wasn't listening. It seemed as though the Lord didn't care. But the Lord was listening. And the Lord did care. And eventually Asaph found what he was so desperately looking for. He didn't find deliverance from his situation. At the end of this psalm, Jerusalem still lies in ruins. The temple is still a smouldering wreck. Dead bodies still line the streets. Asaph didn't find deliverance from his situation, but what he found was what he was really looking for. He found the Lord. The Lord gave ear to him. So maybe here this morning, you're in that spiritual storm of the soul. You doubt your own salvation. A crisis in your life has left you wondering, does God really care about me anymore? You pray and you pray and it hurts. You say, Lord, why have you brought this situation into my life? Lord, don't you know I can't handle this? You say, Lord, please just take this away. I can't cope anymore. Lord, take this away from me. You say, Lord, why did you bring this into my life and then take it away? And you can't understand what God is doing and you wonder, does he really care? And of course, in that situation, the easiest thing to do is to stop praying, isn't it? Because prayer hurts. Because it hurts to keep on coming back to God and pleading with him, but seeming to get no answer. And so the easiest thing is to stay away. And maybe even to stay away from church. Because at church you meet with God's people and you meet with the Lord himself. And meeting with the Lord hurts because it's always a reminder that he hasn't answered that desperate longing of your heart. The easiest thing to do is to stay away. But that's not what Asaph would advise this morning, is it? Asaph would advise that you persist in prayer. I cried to God with my voice, to God with my voice. And then he gave ear to me. There is power in persistent prayer. Okay, but what's the second thing then? Where does Asaph look in a time of distress? Well, he looks to the only place he can look. He looks back to the Exodus. And actually, as you go through the Old Testament, you find that all of the psalmists, all of the prophets, so often, if you like, in their rear view mirror, they got the Exodus. That's why throughout the whole of the Old Testament, the Exodus is never far away. It keeps on coming back. The Exodus was the great demonstration of God's deliverance of his people. And so when Asaph is in a crisis situation, where can he look? Well, the only way he can look is in his rearview mirror. He looks back to God's redemption at the Exodus. And he realizes, if God never failed his people before, why should he fail me now? So, okay, what about us? Where do we look? Well, the Exodus, of course, and every deliverance in the Old Testament is a picture or a precursor to the ultimate redemption that God would perform when we come to the New Testament. All of those deliverances of God's people point us to the cross. And so this morning we're in a more privileged position than Asaph. Asaph, in his rearview mirror, had the Exodus, a picture. In our rearview mirror this morning, we've got the real thing, the cross. The ultimate act of God's redeeming power. The ultimate demonstration of God's love and keeping of his people. And therefore, for us this morning, if we're in a crisis situation, if we're saying, Lord, do you really care about me anymore? Lord, have you deserted me? Then there's only one place we can look. We've got to look in the rearview mirror. We've got to look back to the cross. And as we look back to the cross, what do we see? We see the tremendous love of God. We see the demonstration of God's love on a scale never known before. And if the Son of God would willingly hang on a cross, take upon himself the shame and the pain of my sin, if the Son of God would willingly be cast into the very depths of hell in order that we could be saved, then why would we doubt his love for us now? If God loved us that much, Christian friend, if he loved you that much, that he would give his own son to die on a cross, then surely he still loves you now. Christian friend, if you're doubting the love of God for you today, if you're doubting his wisdom in your life, if you're feeling far from the Lord, then there's only one place this morning where you can find any strength, and that place is the cross. So maybe, Christian friend, it's time to look in your rearview mirror again and to see the love of God demonstrated in the death of his son.